Should we rethink the way that we use police funding? Are there better ways to recruit and educate law enforcement? These are just a few of the topics that we will be speaking on today's Rights and Wrongs podcast. Welcome to the Rights and Wrongs podcast. This is a podcast to talk about rights, wrongs, privileges, and misconceptions. Today, I'm joined by Professor Dio Giovanni. Today, we're going to be talking about military influences in law enforcement and police issues of the day. I'll let Professor Dio Giovanni introduce himself.
Good morning from Boston. My name is Christopher D. Giovanni. I am Associate Professor of Criminal Justice at Massasoit Community College in Brockton, Massachusetts, famous for Rocky Marciano, the only undefeated heavyweight in the world, and Marvin Hagler as well. You got to look him up. I've been teaching for 12 years, tenured and so forth, and close to my full professorship.
Well, thank you. I know Professor G. Giovanni because he was one of my first criminal justice professors, and he taught me a lot of what I know about criminal justice. The big issue right now when it comes to law enforcement in the U.S. is this term of defunding the police. Do you have any views or opinions on that?
Yeah, I do, and it's not because I want to keep getting criminal justice students. If we defund, it'll affect not only the training within the department, which it needs to be increased, in my opinion, but the benefits of financial aid or financial benefits for those that do get a degree, associate, bachelor's, master's, and move up the ranks and get a little, you know, little money for doing so. And that, you know, we know, all of us, you know, here we're in the University of Glasgow and what that can do for the mind and what it can do to open you up to the history of policing and the history of America. I always ask my students, just to go to here, what is the immigrant class that's had it worst in the United States? And they say Black American. And I said, no, they're not immigrants. They were dragged here in chains. So, and the issue of racism is a problem as well.
No, and that's very true. It's interesting you bring up immigration because a lot of us forget that we are immigrants or that we're not immigrants. If you earlier I had a podcast, the first one was on immigration, and I had a rude awakening because school's over. I am now an unemployed immigrant in the United Kingdom. And just thinking about that as a white man from America, like you never think of yourself that way. And right. Criminal justice is a lot about perspective, and there is this us versus them mentality. You also bring up a really good point about the education in law enforcement. Us both being from Massachusetts and going through, we've both taken the exams and gone through the system. Do you have any opinions on like how we actually hire law enforcement? Because I remember I always found it interesting how I get extra points for being a veteran, but my criminal justice background doesn't get me anything.
Yeah. Well, that's currently the system. We're trying to get it changed in the State House. It's a tough road. We do want to benefit, give the benefit to veterans for service. But also, as to selection, you obviously go through your PT standards, you go through your background investigation, and you do an oral board interview. And I think, honestly, given my background of both policing and corrections, and academy trained 26 weeks total, that I would be a good interviewer. And, you know, whether you introduced me as professor or just interviewed me as Christopher D. Giovanni, I think just to get under the skin of the person being interviewed, maybe you throw a shot across the bow and see how he reacts. Because you're going to get shots across the bow, if not shots to your face, excuse my expression, on the street. And start out right here. Who are you? I'm Christopher D. Giovanni. What do you do? None of your business. I am here to interview along with everyone else. As for now, I'm Christopher D. Giovanni. You need to know nothing else. See how he reacts. Or she.
That is very true. That was like one of the craziest things when I moved here to the UK is how the police react totally different here. Because if no one's ever been to the UK, their police aren't armed. When the police are armed, people react and they get very nervous. Sure. And it's just strange as an American because I'm like, oh, they have a gun. That's normal. You don't realize cops that don't have it.
Whereas the opposite when you don't see one.
Yeah. And here it's, the police are always super attentive. I've seen issues on my street. I've came across a person right after they got mugged and we were doing first aid and we had to deal with police. And from situations I've had in the US dealing with similar matters, totally different. To be dealing with a homeless person on the street, dealing with me, someone in a suit, they treat everyone the same, very calm. If someone's getting hyped up and things like, they calm down, go like, deal with that, like being very polite. I've just seen multiple situations like that. And it's just a very like warming thing. But when you come to America, there is that situation where if someone comes aggressively at you, I'm not sure if our law enforcement officers are really taught any other way than aggression back. Where here I've seen law enforcement officers being threatened by people that aren't right in the head or might be on a substance. And the officers just take it very calmly.
Yeah.
It is refreshing.
Well, what I like to say, and this is, I don't think this is only true in Glasgow, in Europe and England. I mean, we know that the father of policing is Robert Peel, Sir Robert Peel from England. He has a Peelian, 9 Peelian principles of law enforcement can be Googled at any time. But also we're trying to do community policing. Honestly, though, having watched it and having been part of it as a police officer, I don't buy it in that I don't think it's being done well. I know in my academy, no one talked about Sir Robert Peel. No one talked about an officer who's the chief of police in Berkeley, California. He's kind of the American father of policing. Is August Vollmer. That's August as in the month, and Vollmer is V-O-L-L-M-E-R. He's a great person to look up. You know, he started police science programs. He started academics in California in criminal justice and obviously focusing on police officers to get involved in it.
And that is interesting. You don't really hear about those people. You do hear something about that person that, I wish I could remember his name. He gets hired by police departments and he's the person that does warrior mindset training.
Well, that's where the paramilitary comes in a little bit.
Yeah, and it's...
Or military. And my 3 drill instructors were state troopers in Massachusetts. They ran the academy for the local cops that were in our academy. There was 45 of us. A little bit different in how we did things in the 90s compared to now. Or how you were academy trained. Just, it was a little more military. And these state troopers, most are military and or when they get through the academy, truthfully, academy is very paramilitary because they're out on the street alone doing car stops in the middle of the night after field training. It's a different game, but they are leaning a little bit more towards community policing, but it's harder with a different style of policing. When the community is the Massachusetts Turnpike, at 3 in the morning, you and him or her.
No, and that's very true. It reminds me of, I was in the hiring process for a Vermont Police Department. Every state has its own education standards. Yours was a 26 program. We both know of someone that went through the Boston Police Academy. From my understanding, it's about 6 months there. The average in the US is about 13 weeks from research I've done. Okay. Here in the UK, it's 18 months. But the variation is very interesting. For I know in the Massachusetts, or something around 17 police academies?
Yeah, both municipal, state, and the bigger cities. I think Worcester runs their own, which is a big city in Massachusetts.
Which I find it, in Vermont, there's only one police academy, and that doesn't matter if you're a state trooper, I was going for campus police.
Yeah.
Do you think there's a better for doing individually, or do you think it's better?
Well, I think other than, and there's 26 weeks, other than, and I think we talked about it the other day, the Texas Rangers, which has quite a storied history, which again, they say one ranger per county, one ranger, one county. Their academy is approximately 46 weeks long, which is almost a year. And I felt like 20's the number, but 26 now versus 17 that I did, plus the 8 that I did when I worked county corrections.
But do you think we should add criminal justice degree aspect to it? Because I know it's nearly 2 years here in the UK, but they treat it as a college degree.
Oh, yeah. No, no.
Okay.
No question about it. I don't think you should get college credits for going through an academy. You get maybe 20 hours of law, not as much case law and Supreme Court, which you were in my class, criminal procedure and criminal law. We do a 16-week semester. Yeah. I don't know how many hours that is. Well, 3 times 16 or 15, 45 hours for each criminal law and criminal procedure. That's 90 hours of law training compared to 20 in a police academy.
That's just when I just find it very, like, this is a huge issue. Because when I do speak to friends that have worked law enforcement here in the UK and they don't understand the difference, I'm like, they're spending 2 years, like, they treat the academy as a college. We're treating right. the academy more as a boot camp, as you said.
Right.
And I think that's a huge importance when it comes to, like, any European listeners that are listening about, we're talking about 20 weeks. It is frightening to the fact that all you need is a high school diploma for most. Usually they prefer military veteran preference and, like, with that, but that is the case. And there's a wide issue of education. I was going to ask, it is very important that law enforcement members do know their history. I've always found it fascinating when you did the introductory law course that you said, how a lot of people don't know the U.S. law enforcement is, I want to say, like, a political arms race.
As like, I mean, the mayors and the governors, and I mean, a lot of people don't know why the governor has his own police department. Essentially, state police is governed by the governor, right? The executive branch, so are the other police departments. But the state police is his. What happened was he realized he didn't have his own police department. I mean, technically, he oversees in some aspects the Boston police, but his police department, his police protection, comes the Massachusetts State Police. They never had their own police department. So, but education, as you know, is so huge. And I use this term very cautiously, but we used to say all you need is a trigger finger and a pulse and a high school diploma or a GED. That makes me nervous. Think about that.
That is true.
And a pulse. And I don't think, I mean, depending, there are ways. The president of the United States cannot kill a man, okay? And I came to a point in my policing, firearm out, aimed. And if this kid came up with a gun, I think I would have won because I had the head start.
No, and that's just, like, such the truth of a lot of things. Because one of the main topics here we're talking about is, like, the military influence of it. And it is very strange when it comes to this. I know you always say we're way too quick to the gun. I always remember that. You're a fan of the baton.
Yeah. And I'm an ex-boxer, so I think that's something huge that needs to be trained more than what we did. Okay, I'm an ex-boxer. I've almost made it to the Golden Gloves to compete in 1990, other than a major injury that kept me from it. But let's put it this way, I could throw a punch.
Yeah, and that's
if you think about this, you know, you look at in particular the recent where he shot the guy 6-7 times in the spine. I don't know, either the nightstick there or an overhand right that probably would have put his head into the beam of the car. Excuse my Boston accent, and he would have dropped like a sack of wheat.
No, and that's true. The main thing is we probably should also be focusing more on social work too, so people don't have to get to the... But it does bring to a point in American policing, violence comes quicker, and it's on both sides. It's right. People see police, and it's just part of that thing. It's like one thing that makes me nervous. Like, you know, I'm a Marine Corps vet.
Of course.
Yeah, I did my brown belt to make MAP, and which is their martial arts program. Every Marine has to learn how to shoot. But even the thing I find strange is that you get veterans, and we're trained, especially in the Marine Corps, it's shoot first, ask questions later.
Of course.
Even when I go to the range, we do things called hammered pairs, which is 2 to the chest, 1 to the head. Right. And we do that for years and years and years. And, like, that's because we're warfare trained. And then they expect us to go to police academy. And I think the academy does, what, 1 week at the range?
Approximately.
And you're expecting me to, like, if I went into the academy, you're expecting me to drop 4 years of that reactionary shooting.
Yep.
And then to get rid of the military. And the other thing is, you talk about hand-to-hand. What was that gentleman that was selling the loose cigarettes in New York?
Goodness, don't ask the name. Big fella. He was about 400, 500 pounds. And you talk about the nightstick. I would have asked him, you know, really, obviously, to not resist. And then I would have said, I don't know if you play basketball or what sports you play, but you're not going to have a kneecap when I'm done with you, and you'll never play sports again. So do me a favor, you know, just turn around and put your hands behind the back. Is that violent? Yes, but now he's dead.
Yeah, and that's
killed him. I wouldn't have killed him, but he would be howling in pain.
It sucks that in America that it sometimes comes to violence, but it's really interesting. That was an illegal headlock they used, but it was by the book military headlock and restraint. Uh-huh. And I'm sure that guy probably served in the military. And like, it's strange for me to think about if I was in that situation, I would probably revert back to how I know how to fight, which is we have lethal and non-lethal.
Right.
But in the military, non-lethal is still... We don't care if we pull someone's arm out of their socket. We don't care if we break an arm.
Right.
And this isn't something that should be in law enforcement. Law enforcement should be looking for this thing. The reason I'm freaking out in the military is like, maybe when I'm fighting this combatant, I can't speak to them because we don't speak the same language, which is a whole issue for military.
Right.
But dude, we're in a warfare. Like, his job, he is paid to kill the combatant. I am paid to kill the combatant.
Sure.
That's not what cops are paid to do. They're here to maintain.
No. You're right. And if I may for a second, I teach my students a couple things. One, intellect over emotion will win. Okay. Try and keep your emotion out of it. The fact is, anywhere between 10 and 15% of the time, it's going to be a quite violent episode. In law enforcement, a few things, I'm sorry. It's either the person is going to comply and get in the handcuffs with your help, or it's going to be a throwdown. It's non-compliance. So it's about 15%. And in the New York example, the headlock was illegal. But as he was saying, I can't breathe in the headlock, he's actually breathing because he's talking. Now, the other thing is, yes, I believe he had a heart attack because of a heart condition. And you can imagine a 400-pound person would. And the reason they weren't indicted per se, I think they got into internal affairs trouble, was because they didn't actually... It was the heart attack that killed him. It wasn't the chokehold, is what they call it. And they got in trouble, I think, for the chokehold. But I don't think any of them were indicted.
Well, that brings back to the whole entire issue of occupational immunity.
Yeah. Which,
that's a huge thing. And if anyone's not familiar with occupational immunity, law enforcement, along with, I think, firefighters and EMTs and doctors are protected by this, that they cannot be prosecuted for doing their job if something went wrong.
Right.
But there is a weird catch-22 that you can be indicted if there's the exact same situation has been indicted before.
Yeah.
But
also, if I may, also, if you break procedure...
Yes.
Okay. You break procedure, which was done in the headlock, but I don't know for sure on that. It has been taught in academies. But if you break procedure and do something outside of what you're trained to do, because I'll tell you this, every training, you're signing off. You are signing off on that test. You know why? Because the police department's going to throw you under the bus first. They have the deepest pockets and the shortest arms to go get the money.
Yeah, and that's where a huge thing I also agree we need to go more in education, because you also made a great point about the heart attack, where it's like, yes, technically he could breathe because he could speak, but we've all had anxiety attacks or we've had issues.
Right.
What you're probably trying to say is he was having trouble breathing, but
right.
I forgive the man. He has someone choking him out and trying to make him unconscious that he wasn't able to perfectly articulate his words.
Right, or really breathe well.
Yeah.
But you guys on top of it.
And honestly, like, that makes sense. Like, if he's saying he's having trouble breathing and you're on top of him giving him trouble breathing, you're dealing with a fight or flight situation right there. Like, if he's going to start fighting you because he can't start breathing, that's not – and you're telling him to comply.
Right.
He might not be able to comply with – he's involuntary at that point. Like, it's there's the things that need to
– he's in a rage and – obviously, one of the 15% that doesn't want to comply.
Which this also brings us right into the another topic you and I were talking about, which was SWAT teams and tactics.
Yeah.
Do you feel that SWAT teams are still relevant, or are they overused? Or
I do, and I'll give you a couple of examples for the need for it, not the situation we would. Hostage situation is a hostage situation. If you cannot get this person to talk down, more than likely you're going to have to take a shot, and it's probably going to be to kill, center mass, and to the head. As police officers, we're taught to shoot the center mass. My father, God bless his soul, said, why can't you shoot their hand? And I said, Dad, this isn't Hawaii 5-0. Book 'em Dano, where we're with a 38 at 20 feet. One of the officers shoots the gun out of the guy's hands. You know that's impossible, almost. You'd have to be, you'd have to be Dirty Harry to be able to have that skill. And additionally to the SWAT, I say this, on no-knock warrants, which we should talk about, and also their availability, there should be, depending on the city, a certain number of SWAT available just in case. And on a no-knock, you and I know it's legal through the United States Supreme Court, but maybe if you're not as nervous, you could knock and just talk the person. Look, you're not going anywhere, front and back door are covered. Please, please, please. We have a legal warrant for your arrest. We have a legal search warrant. Please succumb, put your guns down, and just walk out.
No, and that is so true. The no-knock warrant issue is, there's been so many, if for any of my European listeners that, because this is not a thing in a lot of European countries, a no-knock warrant is a very controversial issue. It literally means the law enforcement has a warrant to search that, so they have to meet that legal procedure, but they do not have to declare an entrance. So before banging, saying we have a warrant, everything that you're saying that would be the scenario, they come in busting the door down.
Right, because there's a fear of weapons on the other side and non-compliance on the other side.
Which, on paper, logistically makes sense, but there have been issues. I remember there was one case, I'll need to look it up, where they were trying to track down one individual. Instead, they knocked down the door of his cousin that has the same name. Yep. His cousin doesn't know what's going on because the police didn't knock down. He just hears his door get kicked down, being a legal firearm owner, grabbed his AR-15, went down the house. All the cops see is, they're doing a no-knock raid because it's a dangerous person. A legal gun owner that has no law-abiding citizen comes down defending his property because this is legal in the United States, and the police shoot him. Right. And at that point, I don't hold the police themselves responsible because I feel like that's more the DA's fault for not getting the proper information. The police are doing what they are, but this is the issue with no-knock warrants. Here in the UK, I have seen a raid happen before. It wasn't with SWAT. They used riot police, riot shields, and a gun in place, and they banged on the door for 20 minutes. They had to bust in, but
right.
At that point, though, you also, like anyone that's in the neighborhood, will say that there's no way that guy did not know the law enforcement was not there.
Right.
I won't speak anything more. I don't know what happened with it. It's just that's what I saw. I wish law enforcement were more often like that.
Right. One of the saddest cases that happened here in Boston, administrative assistant filling out the warrant. She mistakenly, in a dyslexic moment, for example, put 132 Main Street instead of 123. They kicked down the door. It was just a gentleman watching TV. He went into full cardiac arrest, which means his heart stopped and died. Oops. Sorry to say it that way.
Didn't the same thing happen to the priest during that famous case in Boston?
I don't remember that one. The other one was about 25 years ago.
Yeah, I was thinking about the one where the person killed his pregnant wife and then said it was an African-American man, and they started searching around Boston.
Can't think of his name. Smart, I think his name was Smart, last name. Obviously, it wasn't that. And yeah, what he did was eventually jumped off the Tobin Bridge and killed himself.
Yeah, and that's something that when it comes to these no-knock raids and police motion, cops can kill people without guns. There's also so many cases of you got that one excited officer because it's a car chase and police get behind them, and it just, how many people have died because of rollovers and crazy things like that? And that's where there has to be a lot of study in it, because one, it great makes great TV. I'm sure you and I have both turned on the news so much during an crazy car chase on the news.
Yeah.
But it just makes everything so much more unnecessarily dangerous. And it almost makes people want to be a part of this craze.
Right, right, right. Absolutely. Now that we've changed it to follow, if possible, not pursue at high rates. And if they are reporting that they're doing 70 and a 35, the dispatch captain more than likely would say cut off. Cut off and slow down and just follow if possible. And more than likely the state, if not that city, has a helicopter. And of course, there's nothing faster than a two-way radio.
I think that's also another interesting thing that needs to go on. It's not just education of law enforcement officers, but we also need to educate the populace themselves. You always have people talk about like, oh, if you're just polite to the police, then I do that. But I think we also have to teach people how to talk to the police. Like, I've been pulled over, I've been caught speeding. Nothing really seriously came of it because I was polite when the police, I didn't argue with the officer. I just accepted what was going on there. If I have to bring it to court, you bring it to court. Granted, I understand a lot of this is because I'm a white male. I understand for that reason, you get treated a little bit. And I'm not saying this will work for everyone, and there are other exponent points, but we don't teach people how to communicate with the police. And it's not that the police are like this magical figure. It is a dangerous job.
Yeah.
The most dangerous thing is a traffic stop.
Well, statistically, not true, but because bank robberies would be more dangerous, but statistically, on the other side, because it's most often done, you could say it is. Now, I'll tell you, on a traffic stop, if you will, the car was already stopped. My partner and I, great, great guy, U.S. Army, drove by a car. We were in plainclothes, but of course, it's not that hard to spot a plainclothes cruiser. These two guys see us and duck down. A lot of car theft back then. So we loop around and we go to see what's going on. It was dusk, so there's a little more danger. And they reached under the seat, which really is not a good idea when a police officer approaches the car. I was on the driver's side. My partner saw it, and he said he's reaching under the seat, going for something. I had to draw to the side of my waist. I didn't point it, and said, "Show me your hands." So if you get pulled over in the United States, at least, keep your hands on the wheel. Don't reach under your seat.
Well, I find that interesting, too. I remember I had a friend up with me in Boston, and we were driving. He was from the southern states, never dealt with a rotary before. Went the wrong way to rotary at like 2 o'clock in the morning in Dorchester. Two young white guys in a nice rental car. Please pull over. First thing I do, I'm from Boston. I'm sorry, but the second you see those blue lights, your hands are on the dash. Just don't move. But he was from the South, and he's like, okay, I just need to get the registration. You start moving around. And I'm like, don't do that. And like, I'm yelling at him. And the cop comes up as you say like that and like knocks on my window because he sees that I'm compliant, like I'm moving. And like I handed my license, explaining like he's not from here, he's never done it. We just got off with a warning. And I told him, like, they think you're going for a gun. And he goes, oh, like, when I get pulled over, he's like, I have a gun. He's like, the first thing I do is I just show the police I have my gun and put on the dash. I'm like, you do that in Boston, you might get some bullets for the back window.
Right.
But that's – and, like, this is, like, the early 2000s and stuff like that, hopefully, like that. But there are also differences of culture from law enforcement in different states, which we don't talk about. Because, like, and when I was stationed in North Carolina – the sheriff says, like, if you have a gun on you, like, just put on the dash, let us know that you have it.
Right.
And I'm like, that's not what we do. Because I got pulled over with my gun license. I didn't have my gun on me. I got pulled over just for, like, a random check. I just checked me out because I don't know really why. First thing good, they just ran my plate, knew that I had a firearm registered. Asked me, do you have it on you? No, I don't.
Right. I'll tell you this, and I don't know how much time we have, but I'll tell you a quick story. We had a car stop in a small town I worked at on Cape Cod, and we were deciding warrant or warning or ticket. and I give the guy a warning. We look up, and he's marching at us from the car, which you don't ever do. Do not get it. We tell them, do not get out of your car, not because we don't want them to get hit by a car, because we don't know why he's doing it. And then we yell at him, get back in your car. And I said, now he gets a ticket. When initially I said, give him a warning.
Yeah, and that's the
way it is.
And I think that's like a huge conversation that needs to be had, is that policing is a dangerous job. It doesn't need to be. But there is fear on both sides. It is sounds strange because we go back to the whole entire the thing about Sir Robert Peel. One of his things is the police are the people and the people are the police, which means we always should be civil.
Yeah.
But there is an understandable level of fear that needs to go on both sides. Like, because the truth is, at the end of the day, you hear people, oh, it's their job. Their job is to protect us. Like, they put their life on the line. But I don't think that is actually, it is true, but like, it shouldn't, they're not soldiers. They shouldn't be acting as soldiers, and we shouldn't treat them as soldiers.
Right. In reality, the real life on the line, 20 tops, 25% of the time, is really life on the line. The other 75% is just basic calls or boredom, coffee, and just patrol.
The fact that you've had to pull your gun out on duty, you're of the rarity of law enforcement. Most law enforcement officers never pull their firearm out. And the best part is that you were able to put it back without having to
use it.
Going back about the basic call, how do you feel about, there's been petitions and ideas, and I know parts of Massachusetts have even done this, about having social workers and psychologists on call for domestic violence cases?
On call is the word, not first to arrive and start getting mental health teams of two people in the car. And if we know, let's say the caller says, my son has bipolar, my son is schizophrenic, my son has just gotten out of the mental health hospital, send them first, then call the social worker or psychologist, because they're trained in mental health.
You said you had a few pieces of media or a book that you would like to suggest.
For I do. It's called Rise of the Warrior Cop. And I'm not going to read the subtitle, but it's by Radley Belko. Great book. I'm piecing my way through it. I'm working on a second master's and working full time, so I don't have a lot of recreational time reading, but I have started tearing through some of the chapters.
I'll put that and also add that to a link of anything that we've been talking about. Most of the cases we're talking about, I'm going to try and reference. In lieu of this session, instead of me offering a piece of media, I'm going to just ask people, there's a big election coming up, and it's not just to do with the president. I really highly suggest getting out and voting. One, I'm sure most people know who they're voting for president at this point, but that's not the only election. We have state senators going to D.C. and state representatives are going to D.C. You also have your local. Like, I know in my hometown, Alex Mendez is running for Mass General's elective against current sitting Senator Keenan. I'm not saying who to vote for. I'm just saying get out there and learn your information about going on there. Another huge important thing to know is if you have a lot of issues with what we're talking about with law enforcement, 25% of law enforcement answer to a sheriff. And a sheriff is elected by you. 60% of them never get challenged. So if you think you could do that, some cities, like I also know back in my hometown of Quincy, former Mayor Phelan is running for the Norfolk County Sheriff. Not saying what to look at, but go look up your area and know the voting, figure out their stances in certain issues like recidivism rates, like how long people go and how they're doing it. The person that's incumbent might be with your beliefs and values. The person going against them might be, but the only way to know is to figure out and vote. It's a really important year, and I please for the future of our nation, make decisions. And with that being said, I'm going to look at some of the questions we have. So the first question we have is, from the law enforcement point of view, which are the limits between prevention and violence? It's only the judgment of the officer or soldier about the harm of the suspect. What are the criteria to shoot down an unarmed person?
Well, it's a threat level Now, I'll give you an example. My captain, great, great captain, he's my number one as far as I'm concerned, and I've had other captains. When it's a big fella, you might have to. But generally, there needs to be a weapon shown. But also, we know it happens without it. We know that it happens without it. And then it's internal affairs and quite possibly an indictment. I would like to say, if I may, George Floyd, the Minneapolis situation, St. Louis, was the big impetus in what's going on here now in this country. Please read his obituary, not only online, but there's a wonderfully one done in The Economist. George Floyd was not an angel, but I don't think he was the devil by any stretch. Okay? He did his time. He had some serious charges and did some time. But there is a thing called rehabilitation, especially if you want to cut budgets in corrections, that's the one that's going to go first.
No, and that we only had the one question, but that actually brings up a really good point. And that is, do you feel that a convict's time in punishment ever ends in the United States?
I'll tell you what, it doesn't if they have a criminal record that's accessible. In truth, in some ways, I think it's a violation of the due process rights. And I think it's a violation of the Eighth Amendment of the Constitution because their punishment continues after they've done their allotted sentence. That's not fair. If you've done your time for your crime, you know, rhyming there, ooh, three in a row, you got to be given a second chance. If you're not given a second chance, you're in trouble. Greatest thing you do is get a personal job, in my opinion.
That is very true. And it's something I've always, well, not always, like since moving here, it's a crazy thing with American society where American society looks at a lot of crime, and you might disagree with this, but it looks at when you commit a crime and you go to jail, the U.S. society says that's your fault, your failure. It has nothing to back on me.
Right.
Where a lot of other countries, such as like Iceland, Finland, Germany, and stuff like that, which do focus heavily on rehabilitation, they have much lower recidivism rates than we do. They do spend a lot more money in their systems, but less overall because people don't go back. Right. To them, it's a societal thing. You committed a crime because us as a society failed you. We didn't give you the access. Granted, there's always going to be just cruel people. It's human society. You're going to have that. But it is a different way to look at it where I find it very sad that as Americans, we can't see ourselves in others in a lot of ways.
Of course, but for the grace of God, there are why. And additionally, nurture nature, environments, good, bad, and indifferent, is going to make a difference in whether you grow up in a certain way and how you turn out. I will tell you very gladly, I was no angel as a kid, and I ended up in the law enforcement field. Okay, and some friends of mine are very shocked at that. I was no angel, but at the same time, I changed my life.
No, it's true. I've got one last question. Considering serving the forces as a job, what's your opinion on the work environment for officers with respect to fair payment conditions, health services, and well-being?
It's not good. It's not good for the officers, meaning the payment, the health services for mental health for officers that end up with post-traumatic stress disorder. It's not just military that end up with that. I've been diagnosed, you know, very lightly with a chronic PTSD, which is nothing compared to real PTSD, and sought treatment and so forth. But also payment is not good. And one of the biggest fights for police officers is against administration who, in my opinion, forget where they came from. Most came from patrol.
Yeah, and that's, you really don't think about it that much either, but like law enforcement officers really are overworked. I know a lot of people that are get like frustrated at the police. It's like, why are the police officers getting paid 70 to sometimes $100 an hour for a detail? But the truth is they're getting mad that the officers are doing this. But if you actually know the base pay of some officers, like you do have that one exception of that officer that brings $100,000 in a year. But the average cop is below the poverty line.
Right.
Like your local beat cop isn't making a lot of money, and like they need to work those details, and they're gonna go just so they make a survival, which at that point they might do a 14-hour detail, get 4 hours of sleep, and they're back on the streets.
Yeah. My son's mother is a police officer. She worked a detail guy, one of the guys working the job, fell in a manhole cover. I don't remember how he got injured, but basically she saved his life because she was there and called EMTs and EMS and 911 on her radio, essentially. Saved his life.
And it's good, like, the details are important to have. We need to completely relook at the system in whole. Do you have any closing thoughts before we finish?
Yeah, let in law enforcement, any one of them, probation, parole, court systems, prosecution, policing, and corrections. Let's build a better mousetrap. And we need one. And building a better mousetrap takes anecdotal and empirical evidence and statistical research, as well it needs to be studied in so many ways, including having done the job. I think you're looking at some of the best are people that have done the job, and maybe when it's academics or the people that have done the job that you find out a lot from.
All right, thank you. And with that, we're going to end this episode of the Rights and Wrongs podcast. If you enjoyed this and you want to ask questions, you can always email me at therightsandwrongspodcast@gmail.com. Or you can watch these live on Twitch. I have the schedule up on Twitch. It's also on Twitter at Rights and Wrongs 2. Thank you so much, Professor DiGiovanni, for joining me.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for listening.